and blowing up bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell chime and jingle bell time. Dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. In the frosty air. Go gliding in the one-horse sleigh. Giddy up, jingle horse, pick up your feet. Jingle around the clock. Mix and a mingle in the jingling feet. That's the Jingle Bell Rock.
Jingle bell, jingle. It's the Sound Off Christmas Show, 2010. Even though technically it is the day after Christmas. Sunday, December 26th, I am the Solemn Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast, episode 139 of the Sound Off, as we wind down this 2010 calendar year and head into 2011 and beyond. And I'm not going to lie, don't have too many things to talk about this week. Not a whole lot going on in the wrestling world. Obviously, the big story is the release of Caval from World Wrestling Entertainment. We'll talk about that and some Raw, and then we'll just get to your feedback. Hope everybody had a very Merry Christmas, for those of you who celebrate it, or Kwanzaa, as it were, perhaps Festivus. Hopefully everybody made it through the feats of strength okay. Today actually happens to be the birthday of the senior Solemn Monster, my father. His birthday is the day after Christmas, and it was interesting because my father was a huge, and still is, a huge Married with Children mark. I know I'm using wrestling terminology now in everyday life, but he is a Married with Children mark, as I am, quite frankly, a great, great sitcom. And back when I was looking for a Halloween costume, which turned out to be a fail this year, I ended up being Hulk Hogan again, as many of you are aware. I stumbled across one of these 80s-themed websites that has t-shirts and memorabilia for old TV shows and funny t-shirts and hats and stuff like that. And they actually had Married with Children merchandise. And one of the things they had was a classic Pokeye number 33 Al Bundy jersey. So I saw this and I thought to myself, this would make one hell of a birthday gift for Dad in December. And then I came across something even better. A No Ma'am t-shirt with the official No Ma'am logo on it. And of course on the back, it does in fact read National Organization of Men Against Amazonian Masterhood. I realized that all of this is completely going over the heads of people who don't know what Married with Children is or never watched the show. If you've never watched the show before, you really do have to owe it to yourself to just watch a couple of episodes. More so, I think, from like season 3 on is when it really got good and raunchy. Just a fantastic TV show. You could buy the DVD. So I figured these are two of the best gifts I could possibly get this man for his birthday. A man who is very difficult to get gifts for. In fact, I rarely even bother because what do you get somebody if you have absolutely no idea what they want, other than a gift card? But a gift card is, I've gotten enough gift cards to where I thought this would make for one hell of a birthday gift. And in fact, it did. He was very happy with it. And so it was a good post-Christmas for the Solemn Monster. My gifts went over very well. So fortunately, I didn't get any gifts myself, but I like to give people things. I like to bring joy into other people's lives. I'm not too big on getting gifts myself, although certainly, if people want to send me something, you're more than welcome to do so. In case you couldn't tell, I'm a little under the weather here. Just so pissed off. I was at a Christmas party the other night, and as soon as I came in, you know, the person, you know, you kind of go, oh, how are you? And, you know, you give the person a kiss on the cheek and whatever. And it was after I already kissed this person on the cheek that I was informed, oh, by the way, I have a cold. Really? Thanks for telling me. As soon as it happened, I knew exactly what was going to happen. And sure as shit, I got sick again. So, not too happy about that, being that I was just sicker than a dog for like a month. Hopefully this will pass quickly, but no, not in a good mood as far as that goes. So just bear with me here. I suppose we should just start with the big news. Actually, when this news broke a couple of days ago, I was posting some other stuff. I think I had just posted the latest SE Scoops mailbag on the main page when the news of Caval's release broke. And I give credit to whoever it was on my Facebook page at facebook.com/thesolomonster. Cheap plug. I give credit to whoever it was who made that post about Caval being released, because I had not seen anything. Apparently WWE.com had put up one of their little blurbs about wishing Caval the best in his future endeavors, and they had mutually come to a release with one another. And I saw that Facebook post and thought, this can't possibly be true. This must be some sort of Christmas rib. Fortunately, it was not, and Caval is in fact gone from WWE. Now, obviously, when the news broke, everybody was railing on WWE. I was pissed off at WWE, and quite frankly, I still am, even though it seems as though Caval instigated or asked for the release on his own. It was something that he wanted. He had went to management and said, I want out. And, you know, more so, I think, than any other time in history, WWE seems to be okay. Now, this is not universal. This is not to say that if John Cena came to Vince McMahon and said, I want my release, that Vince McMahon would give him his blessing. But the company seems more open now than ever before to letting unhappy people go if that is what they so desire. Now, again, I'm sure there's a 90-day non-compete clause. You know, Caval can't just jump to TNA tomorrow if he wanted to. I'm not so sure he would want to go back, quite frankly. And remember, Caval was in TNA before he came to WWE. And really, just to give some perspective here for those people who don't know, you go back a little bit further. You know, Brandon Silvestri, which is Caval's real name, he competed in the independents for many, many years. He made a name for himself as Low Key, which I thought was a pretty cool name. And I guess it was his name, it was his, I guess he owns the rights to it, what have you. And I remember when he was negotiating with TNA, there was some, trouble as far as TNA wanting to own the Low Key name, and Low Key wisely did not want to sign away the rights to the name that he used to build a name for himself on the independent circuit. So they settled on the name Senshi, which is what he was known as in TNA, and I don't really remember him being overly happy in TNA. I believe he was a former X Division champion. But he left TNA and went to WWE Developmental. And he's been in Florida Championship Wrestling, or I should say he was in Florida Championship Wrestling for quite some time. He actually suffered a very serious knee injury. He might have, I don't remember if it was reconstructive knee surgery, if it was an ACL tear. Whatever it was a very serious knee injury that kept him out for, if it wasn't a year, it was pretty close. And he came back and eventually was added to the roster for NXT Season 2, a season that he won. He beat out people like Husky Harris and Mike McGillicuddy, who are enjoying far more prominent positions on the main roster than Caval ever did. But regardless, Caval was the winner of NXT Season 2. You may remember Lay Cool were his pros. They played it up for comedy. You know, he ran with it. He did the best he could with it. I always thought he was a very well-spoken guy. Pretty good mic skills. Yes, he's not as physically imposing as, you know, Vince McMahon would like, but that's part of his appeal. You know, here's this small guy who just goes around kicking ass. He's a very good worker. I very much enjoy watching his matches. I think he's had some pretty good matches on SmackDown, but he never got a shot. I mean, he was never given a chance. And doing that 20-second job last week or whatever it was to Drew McIntyre and the Future Shock DDT was just fucking pathetic. And I guess it really shouldn't be all that shocking. I mean, I guess it was a situation where WWE told him they didn't have anything creatively for him. And so he opted to ask for his release, and it was granted. And I can't say that I blame the guy for that. But, you know, for the people now who are like, well, everybody jumped the gun. You see, it wasn't WWE's fault. I'm going to disagree with you on that. I'm going to disagree with you on that because, look, I'm sure that every person when they come into WWE thinks their shit don't stink. especially if you are an experienced worker who has already been on the independents. Maybe you've been in TNA, whatever the case may be. So you're not a rookie. You know, and on NXT, Caval was treated as a rookie, which in a way is kind of a slap in the face. But regardless, Caval is not a rookie. Caval has many years of experience under his belt, and he happens to be a damn fine worker. And the fact that WWE would tell him, we don't have anything for you. The fact that WWE couldn't come up with, and they don't have to come up with some bullshit character or some elaborate storyline. You see, that's why I don't buy this whole creative has nothing for you. There's no such thing. If creative doesn't have some sort of weird, wild, and wacky idea for you, then at the very least, they can put you out there and have good matches. There's nothing wrong with having a good wrestler who goes out and has good matches. Look at Daniel Bryan. You know, were it not for this stupid bullshit they have where the Bella Twins want to fuck him and he's a ladies' man, but he's not aware that he's a ladies' man. If you strip away that stupid gimmick, what is Daniel Bryan? He's the United States champion who happens to be a damn good wrestler. People get into his matches. They pop for the LaBelle lock. That's what he is. That's his gimmick. There's nothing wrong with that. And he's getting over with it. I don't think Caval is all that different in that, look, if you don't have some weird idea, who cares? Put the guy out there. He has great matches. Eventually something will come to you. But no. They put him out there every week. They treat him like a jobber. It's no wonder Caval would want to ask for his release. Believe me, if Caval was on a winning streak, if Caval was having great matches and being featured prominently on SmackDown, or had his own angle going on, there's no way he ever would have asked for his release. He worked so hard and so long to get to WWE. Why would he want to just throw it all away? Unless he felt he was being treated like shit, which he was. At least on TV. I mean, the guy spent so many years on the independents. And to me, he spent so much time in Florida Championship Wrestling, in developmental. Like I said, got hurt with a knee injury. He was out for many, many, many months. Had to rehabilitate himself, come back. Then he was first cast on NXT. So he dedicated so many months and so many years of his life to get to that point. It's pretty sad that he felt compelled to quit, if that is in fact what happened here. And I can't say that I blame him. And I'm not gonna say that, well, WWE then all of a sudden bears no responsibility. No, WWE is as much to blame as they were when this news first broke and people thought that Caval was just randomly fired. I mean, you have a multi-million dollar company with so many supposedly smart people backstage. You have a supposedly creative team, which is a funny term to use for a team that seems to not have many ideas for a lot of talented people. It's absolutely their fault. You can't come up with something for a guy like this. I remember when they first signed him and he was in developmental. At the very beginning, the thought was that he was going to be brought up to the main roster as a heel rival for Rey Mysterio. Here's two very talented guys, about the same size. I mean, maybe Caval's a little bit bigger, I don't know, but I think that would have made for one hell of a feud. I thought to myself, Rey Mysterio and Caval. I like that. That could work. And maybe they come up with some backstory where Caval used to be a partner of Rey's or a friend of his, or he, you know, grew up with Rey, since everything has to be a storyline in WWE. I just came up with a storyline right there. Caval and Rey Mysterio, they grew up together, they were really good friends, and Caval all of a sudden has a beef with Rey because Rey didn't get him into WWE, so he had to fight, scratch, and claw his way for years through the independents, through TNA. He finally gets to WWE, and now he's going to take his frustrations out on Rey Mysterio. And from there, the two of them go on to have some great fucking matches. I just came up with that in 15 seconds. You can't come up with an idea for this guy? Fuck you. That's what I say to WWE. Fuck you. So anyway, yeah, to all these people who say, well, you know, see, it's not WWE's fault. No. Dig a little bit deeper. It is WWE's fault. Caval didn't just wake up one morning and say, you know what? I work for the biggest wrestling organization in the world. I'm probably also getting paid more money now than I ever was before. I've got my own merch. I don't even know if he had his own t-shirt. I'm assuming he must have, but I don't know. He didn't just wake up randomly and make this decision in a split second. There had to have been a reason for it. So now Caval is gone. He's going back to the independents. He'll be working under his old name of Low-Key, and in fact, he's already signed for his first post-WWE booking, which apparently is going to be on January 28th for Impact Championship Wrestling. He'll be facing TNA star The Amazing Red in what I am sure will be a fantastic match. So, you know, it's a little bit different than the Daniel Bryan situation. Daniel Bryan was fired for reasons that, quite frankly, are still unclear to me. But eventually the company, you know, realized the error of their ways and hired him back. This is not exactly the same thing. Again, he wasn't fired so much as it appears Cavall asked for his release. But perhaps down the road, you know, since this was a mutual parting, perhaps he'll be able to come back when they actually have something for him. But I just think the whole situation is a shame. And, yeah, NXT Season 2 winner gone from WWE. Too bad he couldn't enjoy the same level of success post-NXT that people like Wade Barrett and Slater and Gabriel and all those guys were able to enjoy. All right, so since the last show, we had the TLC pay-per-view, which supposedly was pretty good. There were some stinkers on it, but there were some really great matches, too. John Morrison and Sheamus apparently had a really good match, and my prediction came true, so I was happy. John Morrison wins the contract. He is the number one contender for the WWE Championship. It looks as though there will be a Miz Morrison title match at the Royal Rumble next month. That has not yet been officially announced. That's, you know, I assume that's where the title match would take place. You know, they can get away with that sort of thing. The Royal Rumble is really based on the Royal Rumble match. That's really what the pay-per-view is sold on. How strong the championship match is, I don't personally think means too much. I mean, I'm just thinking back to some Royal Rumbles over the last decade. You know, Royal Rumble 2003, which, actually, I'm sorry, was it 2003? No, it was 2004. Had a WWE championship match, Brock Lesnar defending against Hardcore Holly. Now, I remember this, and I actually thought it was pretty well built up. If I remember correctly, I believe it might have been based around the first match the two ever had together a few years earlier, where Lesnar dropped Holly on the back of his head and almost broke his neck on SmackDown, which was not Brock's fault at all. Holly sandbagged him on it. He wouldn't even go up for the powerbomb. In case you didn't realize, Hardcore Holly was a bit of a prick. And in that situation, he kind of got what he deserved. But that was your title match at the 2004 Royal Rumble. Not exactly the strongest title match in the world, but they knew it didn't matter because they have the Royal Rumble match, and that's really what people care about. 2006, which I understand why they did it. You know, The Undertaker made a big return, one of his, you know, 27 million returns over the years. At the end of that pay-per-view, and they had this big fancy special effects deal, and I guess they wanted to go off the air with that. To this day, I still question their sanity main eventing the pay-per-view, not with the Rumble match. That was the year Rey Mysterio won. The final match on that show for the championship, if you can believe it, was Kurt Angle defending against Mark Henry. Yeah. So, we've had some pretty shitty title matches before, and I don't look at Miz and Morrison as being shitty at all. It doesn't have the star power that most main events have because we're so used to seeing either Cena, Orton, Michaels, Triple H, or Batista, or Undertaker in those title matches. And it's actually refreshing to think that we might, I say might here, I'm going to tell you why in a second, we might have a fresh match at the Rumble. Now, why do I say might? There's been no reason given for us not to think that they would not add Randy Orton to this match. You know, we saw the little backstage thing last week with Morrison and Orton kind of confronting each other, and Randy Orton doesn't really have anything else going on right now. He's still essentially feuding with The Miz. Now, there's a lot of time between now and the Rumble. They have one of these rare periods where they've got a solid 5 or 6 weeks left to promote this pay-per-view instead of the usual 2 or 3 weeks. So a lot of things could happen between now and then. We're kind of in a holding period right now. I don't expect shit to happen on Raw this week. You know, things aren't really going to start to heat up, I think, until the first or second week of January. But would not shock me at all to see Randy Orton added to this thing and make it a triple threat match, because WWE is so scared to deviate from the norm. You know, even though it would make more sense to have Orton in the Rumble match, and maybe he will be. I'm just saying, let's not discount the possibility that Randy Orton could be added to this match. It may not be Miz and Morrison straight up. So we'll see what direction they want to go in. That's not the direction I would go in. I would just let Miz and Morrison have their title match and see what they can do. Let's see here. Kane, unfortunately, is no longer the World Heavyweight Champion. I know we're all so sad. Edge is now a 10-time World Heavyweight Champion. Think about that. And think about what that says about wrestling today compared to even 10 years ago, let alone 15, 20, or 25 years ago. That Edge won his first world championship in January of 2006. And so in under 5 years, he's now won 10 world titles. Amazing. So Edge is your champion on the SmackDown brand. I thought maybe they would go with Alberto Del Rio. They did not. I'm sure it's just a matter of time. They're kind of grooming him, I think, to be the next big thing. And then, of course, John Cena and Wade Barrett have their chairs match. It looks as though that feud is over. It's a shame. They could have gone a lot of different ways with it, and I think the way they chose, again, was not the best way. It had more potential, but I personally, they bungled it and they fucked it over so much that I'm happy it's over. And maybe it's not. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Nexus is going to come back in a couple of weeks and jump Cena all over again. Because I don't believe we've seen the last of Nexus. I do believe they will be back. I had read where booking plans were already made for a litany of WWE guys through the month of February, which I find hard to believe that WWE would actually do long-term booking. But last I heard, Nexus was in those plans. They were penciled in through February. Maybe plans changed. I don't know. But it looks like this Cena-Barrett thing was blown off at the pay-per-view. Barrett was supposed to be killed, I guess, with these chairs that fell on him. And it looked kind of ridiculous. This giant wooden pallet protecting him from all the chairs. Not that I wanted him to die. But, you know, they showed replay after replay after replay. And to me, it didn't look all that impressive, because there's Wade Barrett laying under a giant wooden pallet. What's so horrible about dropping metal chairs on top of the wooden pallet? But whatever. So Cena comes out on Raw. Let's talk about Raw for Monday night, and cuts this long promo. He was really over with the crowd. People were going nuts. Texas, it's not always true, but Texas tends to have a lot of hot crowd. And I remember one of the hottest crowds I've ever seen, ever for a Raw match, maybe any WWE match. In terms of just consistent heat, like, people were really into this match. I might have talked about this on the show before. It was a 10-man tag on Raw from, I want to say, February. February 7th, for some reason. Wow, if I'm right, that would be something else. I'm actually going to check right now. Let's see. It was from February 7th, 2000, if my memory is correct. 2000, February. February 7th was a Monday, so I'm pretty sure that was it. And it was a 10-man tag on Raw's War. It was The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool against Triple H and The Radicals, which would have been Triple H. I think X-Pac might have been in the match. Chris Benoit, Perry Saturn, and Dean Malenko? I know Eddie Guerrero was not in the match. He was hurt. This was right after the Radicals debuted in the WWF and jumped over from WCW, and I know Eddie had dislocated his elbow. It's a pretty gruesome injury, doing a frog splash on SmackDown like his first night in. But that 10-man tag, and you can find it on YouTube, I've watched it before, was unreal. Unreal in terms of heat. I mean, people were so into this match. It was one of the most fun matches I've ever seen inside a WWE ring. And it even had a fun ending, too, in that there was a lot of brawling going on when the match was over. The lights went out. Music started playing, and out walked Paul Bearer. A slimmed-down version of Paul Bearer in a red jacket. Now, we had not seen Paul Bearer in WWE in quite some time, so it was quite shocking seeing him walk out onto the Raw stage. And then all the pyro goes off, and it was Kane. Now, this was kind of funny to me. I know I'm going off track here for a second, but just bear with me. Undertaker had been off TV for many months. And Undertaker was actually supposed to come back right around that time period, around January or February of 2000. This was when Undertaker, he needed surgery. He was doing the Ministry gimmick. This was September of 99. And Undertaker was supposed to be in the main event, in fact, of the September 99 pay-per-view. It was a six-pack challenge for the WWE Championship, which had been vacated after Vince McMahon won the belt on SmackDown. There were six guys in the match. Undertaker was one of them. And I guess he was hurting real bad because he was taken out of the match and replaced by the British Bulldog. And Undertaker was off TV for many months. He was supposed to come back. And then I guess in rehabbing and preparing to come back, he tore his pec in training, I guess in the gym. So Undertaker wasn't going to be coming back so fast. And I think that was the spot for him, but I guess we'll never know. Instead, it was Kane, who they made this big deal about how Kane is back, which I thought was funny because Kane literally had been off TV for maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks at the most. It wasn't like, you know, Kane was gone for months and months. But still, the way the whole thing was handled, this was back when Kane actually looked like a badass. They came to the ring, Kane cleared house. I mean, the crowd was going nuts. That was at the Reunion Arena in Dallas, Texas, which I don't know if Reunion Arena is still there or not, but the point to this long-ass story is Texas crowds rock. Thumbs up to Texas. So the crowds at Raw and SmackDown this week were pretty loud, were pretty vocal, and they were very vocal for John Cena. This segment was really, really, really long, but I will say this. When Vicky Guerrero came out with Dolph Ziggler, anybody who emails me, and there are people, wondering why Vicky Guerrero has a job, that segment right there is reason number one why. Vicky is not the best performer in the world. Don't get me wrong. She's not a master thespian. But Vicky has made tremendous improvements in the last couple of years. She gets it now. She is a WWE superstar. And she's a superstar in the heat-seeking department because this woman gets more heat than most male wrestlers do on the roster. I mean, there are people that would kill for the kind of heat that Vicky Guerrero gets. This crowd hated this woman, and they only got louder every time she tried to speak. So this actually saved the segment. I thought it was going on too long, but when I saw this and how into it the crowd was, this was great stuff. And it led to a John Cena-Dolph Ziggler match later in the show. I thought they had a hell of a match. And I bought into that false finish when he put the STF on Ziggler, and the referee was distracted. I thought for sure he was tapping out then and there. So it went on a couple more minutes, and then ultimately Cena won. But I thought it was a really good match. They rematched on SmackDown the next night. I'll talk about SmackDown in a second. Compared to Raw the previous week with the Slammies, this Raw was like the best Raw of all time. On its own, it was a pretty good show. But compared to that Raw the week before, this was a five-star effort. I was really, really happy to see Daniel Bryan and William Regal have, even though it was only four, maybe 5 minutes, they had a nice little match with each other. Regal's not in the best of shape physically, but, you know, he was still very good. Gave Daniel Bryan a little clap after the match. And you know, even said on his Twitter, I guess people were asking Regal, you know, were you being sarcastic after the match when you were clapping for Daniel Bryan? He said, no, I wasn't being sarcastic at all. You know, Regal legitimately trained Daniel Bryan. He's probably even credited more so than Shawn Michaels is, because I don't know how long. I don't think Shawn Michaels trained Daniel Bryan for too long. I think Daniel Bryan might have been one of the first graduates from that first class that Shawn Michaels had when he opened his wrestling academy. Back when during his first retirement. But it was really Regal who took Daniel Bryan under his belt and trained him. So it must have been a real thrill for Regal. I know Regal worked with Daniel Bryan in the recent overseas tour, but to be able to work with him live on Raw had to have been a trip. And for the 4 minutes or whatever it was a damn good match. I'd love to see these guys get 15 minutes on pay-per-view to see what they would do. So that was really cool to be able to see that on Monday night. Thought the main event six-man tag was pretty good, too. Jerry Lawler gets the pin on The Miz. I said this in the mail. I think it was the mailbag. The SE Scoops mailbag from this past week. Somebody asked me a question. Why is Jerry Lawler getting so much attention of late? Why is he getting put over so much? And I don't know that there's any specific reason for it, but what I hope comes out of this is that Jerry Lawler finally gets the one thing that has eluded him, and that he really, like, legitimately wants more than anything else. He wants the ability to say that he wrestled at least one time on a WrestleMania show. For all the shows he has announced and appeared at, the King has never wrestled at WrestleMania, and that to him is a big deal. For everything else he's done in his career, it's kind of the one thing that sticks in his craw. He's needled Vince McMahon about it before, you know, hey, by the way, don't forget. And in fact, Lawler tells the story of a couple of years ago. He was talking to Vince McMahon and mentioned to him, he said, you know, I've never had a WrestleMania match. And he says that Vince was like, shell-shocked by this. Like, really? Jerry Lawler has never wrestled at WrestleMania. Well, next WrestleMania, we're going to have to give you a match and fix that. And King got his hopes up and thought he was really going to get the match, and then Vince McMahon never said word one about it. He never did get that match, which I can totally believe. I can believe that Vince really did believe what he said at the time and then just completely forgot. So my hope is that, being that the King has been getting so much attention and we're getting very close now to WrestleMania, just give the guy a match. Put him in the ring with Michael Cole. I don't care who. You know, put him in a meaningless six-man tag. It doesn't have to be a main event level match, nor should it be. Just give Jerry Lawler his one WrestleMania match. He's 61 years old. He looks damn good and moves around pretty damn good for 61, don't get me wrong. But I don't know how many more chances he's going to have. You know what I mean? So I'm hoping, if nothing else comes out of this, he gets a WrestleMania match. I think that would be well-deserved. But that was pretty much Raw. The one thing that puzzled me, and maybe somebody listening to this can shed some more light on this for me. Why did John Cena give some dude a bouquet of flowers backstage? What was that? Or rather, I should say, somebody gave John Cena flowers. That's what it was. I'm sorry. Some dude gave John Cena flowers. What the hell was that about? Keep that off camera, buddy. TMI. I didn't see all of SmackDown from Tuesday night. Of course, SmackDown aired live on Tuesday this week. It was WWE week on USA, and there was no chance in hell I was watching all 6 or 9 hours or whatever the hell it was of wrestling. But I did see part of SmackDown. I thought the Cena-Ziggler stuff, again, was really good. This time, Vicky Guerrero was in there. It was a handicap match. She wasn't in there for very long. Cena wins again. I know people are going to be upset about that. But again, I thought Dolph Ziggler probably opened a lot of eyes this week. He was really, really good. And there's a lot of things about him that do remind me of Kurt Hennig. You know, Mr. Perfect. And I know Mr. Perfect was one of his influences, I think, getting into the business. I think he said that before. Just in terms of the way he moves, some of the moves that he actually uses, like the neck snap that Mr. Perfect was known for, the bumps that he takes. I mean, Hennig oversold a lot of bumps, but he took these big bumps that certainly didn't do his back any favors. But Ziggler reminds me a lot of him. But here's one thing that I haven't heard people kind of pick up on, the biggest thing maybe of all, that makes me think Mr. Perfect when I think of Dolph Ziggler. The guy has the word perfection in his fucking theme song. That right there is a dead giveaway. Anyway, I really like what I saw from him this week, and wouldn't mind seeing him over on the Raw brand, but again, I don't trust that they would know what to do with the poor guy if they moved him over. All I know is, again, he had great matches with Cena this week, and if you go back go back a month or two, the series of three matches he had on TV at Bragging Rights, Raw, and then SmackDown with Daniel Bryan were top 10 material as far as top WWE matches of the year, so good for him. The SmackDown rating was up from its normal range. I think typically on Sci-Fi, SmackDown's been pulling like a 1.7, which has been pretty disappointing to the folks at Sci-Fi. They were expecting at least a 2 or above, but Sci-Fi's a shitty network, so, you know, what do you expect? SmackDown was up, of course, on USA this week to a 2.2. Now, I know everybody was reporting a 2.5. It was not a 2.5. It was actually a 2.2. Which is still a much better rating than it normally does. And a lot better than Impact, although that's kind of an unfair statement since, USA is a much stronger network than Spike. So naturally I would expect that the show would do better than Impact. But still, this was, when WWE's schedule changes, for example, when they have a 3-hour Raw, no matter how many times they plug it, people either don't care or they forget to watch the first hour, and it's always in the 2.0 range, and then at 9 o'clock it shoots back up over a 3. Doesn't matter what they do. So, again, the point is, WWE fans are either really, really stupid, or they just don't give a shit about the product enough to tune in when the show actually starts. So, with SmackDown airing on a completely different network, on a completely different night, you would expect that a lot of people would either forget, or they wouldn't remember what channel it was on. They'd put Sci-Fi on, or they would put Sci-Fi on Friday and not realize the show aired on Tuesday. Even so, the show pulled a 2.2, which, again, is a hell of a lot more than what Impact draws in their normal time slot. So, you know, I don't know what that says about TNA, but it ain't good. And speaking of TNA, before we move on here, I think it's worth noting that TNA Reaction, which is one of the few bright spots of that product. I've said it before on this podcast. I think the show is a great concept. It's gritty. It's real. It's a little over the top sometimes. You know, it's not like every show is perfect. But I think it's an idea that if WWE were going to steal something from TNA, which is rare, although they have done that too before, that would be an idea I would not mind seeing WWE implement. But, you know, unfortunately, I don't think it fits with their PG direction. But it is one of the few things I like about TNA. And I bring this up because next week is being listed as the season finale of Reaction. And at least at this point, there is no Reaction listed at all on the January schedule for Spike TV. Which means that either Reaction is done for good after this upcoming week, or at the very least, the show is going to be taking a hiatus for a while. So one of the few bright spots about TNA will be gone after this week. Not good. Not good. Can't they just eliminate Impact instead and just move Reaction into the Impact time slot? I'm being serious. Like, just get rid of Impact. And just expand Reaction to an hour from 9 to 10. I'd watch that. Alright, so next week, on the 140th episode of this here Solid Monster Sounds Off show, I'm going to have my own little personal best of WWE 2010 top 10 countdown, which is essentially just counting down the top 10 things, moments, angles, matches. It could be anything. It's not a list of matches, but perhaps a match could be on there. It's the top 10 best things from WWE in 2010. Have that countdown next week. It'll be the first episode of the Sound Off for 2011. It'll be a New Year's weekend edition of the show next week, so that gives you a little something to look forward to there. In the meantime, feel free to email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com with your own thoughts about your favorite matches, moments, and so forth from WWE or wrestling in general in 2010. Because for all the crap and all the bad stuff and all the bitching and all the moaning, there was a lot of good stuff this year mixed in with all the bad. And I think that for a change, instead of just focusing on the negative and trying to, you know, in most cases, you know, it's constructive criticism. But it would be nice to kind of reflect back on the positives of 2010 as we head into this new year. So that should be a fun time next week. And what we'll do now is we'll go right to your feedback. I got a lot of letters. I want to try to get to as many as I got. Oh, by the way, I should mention this before we do move on here. Speaking of top 10 countdowns, WWE.com has a new video, a feature posted, which highlights the top 10 WWE submission superstars of all time. And I'm going to read this list to you here, starting from number 10 down to number 1. Again, top 10 WWE submission specialists of all time in history. Number 10, Taz, which I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Taz was known as a submission machine and a suplex machine, and he certainly knew a lot of submission holds and used one as his finisher, so I have no problem with that. If anything, I'm a little surprised that they would take the time to highlight a current TNA personality on this list, although there is another TNA personality on here as well. Actually, two of them. Number 9, William Regal. Number 8, Sergeant Slaughter, which, aside from the camel clutch, I really can't think of another submission I've ever seen Sergeant Slaughter. Well, it's not true. He did use the Cobra clutch. But still, I don't look at Sergeant Slaughter as being a submission guy, so I call bullshit on that one. Number 7, Daniel Bryan, which, Hey, Daniel Bryan knows a lot of submission holds, but top 10 of all time? I don't know if he's cracked that list just yet, but he's number 7. Number 6 is Dean Malenko. Not so sure about that. Number 5 is Chris Jericho. Number 4 is Ric Flair. Number 3 is Bob Backlund. Number 2 is Kurt Angle. And number 1 is Bret the Hitman Hart. So that's your list from WWE.com. Not as controversial, I think, as WWE's top 50 greatest of all time list, but still, I call bullshit on some parts of this list. Again, I don't know how Sergeant Slaughter ends up on a top 10 like this. You know, even Dean Malenko. I know Malenko competed in WWE, but I look at him as more of a WCW guy, and I don't know. I guess that doesn't have anything to do with it, but there's one name that kind of jumped out at me when I thought about this that is missing from this list, who, quite frankly, I would have had, if not at number one, probably in the top three. He was a former Intercontinental Champion, a Tag Team Champion, a King of the Ring winner. Ken Shamrock. Ken Shamrock is the man who made the ankle lock popular in WWE in the 90s. Kurt Angle ripped it off from him. Jack Swagger ripped it off from him. But it was Shamrock who popularized that move. And he knew, you know, certainly a slew of other submissions as well. He never was world champion, but he became a big star. Like I said, in WWE, former King of the Ring. And I think Ken Shamrock should have been on this list. You know, of the people on here, would I rank Bret Hart above Kurt Angle? I probably would put Angle at number one. I understand why they probably didn't want to make Kurt Angle number one. You know, but whatever. I guess I can't disagree with too much of this list, but it's certainly not perfect. So I just wanted to mention that here before we move into your feedback. All right, here, this question comes from Dustin. I wanted to read this first, and this is why I waited until the mailbag to talk about this. I didn't forget in my Raw review. Dustin wants to know, what are my thoughts on CM Punk attacking John Cena on Raw and SmackDown this week? Well, you may remember last week, I think it was last week, when I talked about CM Punk at the Slammies, making that comment about somebody backstage having wronged him, I did mention that the first thought I had when I heard him say this was John Cena. And then I said that it was probably going to be Randy Orton. WWE had actually planned on it being Orton, apparently, at least as of that week. And of course, I guess they changed their mind for whatever reason. Maybe they came up with another idea for Orton. They had a potential backstory there with Orton. I think I mentioned in that a couple of years back, Orton cost CM Punk the world championship. And I don't know that Punk ever got his revenge, but I called it. I didn't know for sure. It was a guess on my part, but I called it. Cena was my first guess. And maybe the logic is not going to be the same, because my whole logic was, well, Punk's been on commentary the last couple of weeks, and Cena knocked over a soda, but he also threw one of his armbands at him and kind of pissed off CM Punk. Maybe when Punk finally cuts a promo and lets us in on exactly why he has been attacking Cena, he'll have a completely different explanation for it. Whatever the explanation is, though, it looks like Cena is the person Punk was referring to, so I was happy to be right about that. And my hope is that they can carry this thing out for a while, perhaps into WrestleMania. I don't know if WWE would have the balls to involve John Cena in a non-championship, non-main event type match at WrestleMania. So if they blow this off at the Royal Rumble, or if they blow this off at Elimination Chamber, I'm going to be very upset about this. But I think Punk and Cena, who have had at least one, maybe two matches before. In fact, Punk and Cena were having a match when Nexus first attacked Cena back in June. And now that I think about it, maybe that'll play into this whole thing. Perhaps, you know, maybe when Nexus... Because you may remember during that attack, Punk came back into the ring. This was when Punk was wearing a mask. And Punk came into the ring, and he too got beaten down by Nexus. And perhaps that will somehow play into his explanation. Maybe Cena didn't come to his aid or something. I don't know. But I think there's the potential for some great matches here. CM Punk deserves it. He's a fucking phenomenal performer. The sad part about all this is I would assume that with him being back in action, that we have seen for now the end of CM Punk on commentary. Now, maybe not. Maybe he'll continue to do some announcing, but if he's back and if he's in a storyline with John Cena, there's no reason for him to be sitting at the commentary booth anymore. So this makes me very sad. I knew it was going to come to an end. And I made the comment on this show before that the one bad thing is in January, which is when I figured Punk was going to come back, and obviously they bumped up his return. But I figured he was going to come back in January, and just when he was about to come back is when he was really going to hit his stride and become great on commentary. And apparently he's done with commentary a little earlier than expected, but he was one of the few highlights of Raw in most weeks. I mean, his commentary was refreshing, it was different, it was funny, it was witty, and I, for one, am going to be very disappointed to no longer hear CM Punk on commentary. But I'm all for a Cena Punk feud. I think, you know, finally, Punk being put to good use instead of being wasted in some meaningless comedy feud on SmackDown with Big Show. You know, you put Punk in there with the top star in the company, and I think you have a recipe there for something pretty damn great. Some pretty damn great mic work as well. See here, we got another letter. Dear Solomonster, it's Chris from Iowa. Been a fan since episode 127. Just got done listening to last week's show, and I agree with what you said about The Shield. It's one of the best TV series I've ever seen. I was also hooked after the very first episode, and I own the entire series. I even got some of my friends into it as well. Anyway, my question is, about a month ago, there was a picture on SEScoops.com with Hulk Hogan flashing his junk on camera. In this picture, Hogan is playing video games with Jimmy Hart, and his daughter Brooke is present. There was some heat with this. Hogan said it wasn't his junk, but I never heard anything about what really was shown. Do you know anything about this? What are your thoughts? Well, Hulk Hogan insisted that he never really showed his penis. Let's just call it what it is. And that he would never do such a thing in public, which is actually a really smart move considering that his balls are probably shriveled to the size of two peas after all the roids he's pumped himself with over the years. There's a visual for you. They did end up releasing the unedited footage. I mean, this whole thing was fucking stupid, but they released the unedited footage, and it proved that he was, in fact, correct. He really only flashed his underwear and not his python. So, that's pretty much all there is to that story. Got a letter here from John, who appears to be a Navy man, so thank you, John, for serving your country. Big fan since episode 111. Had a question, or more of a possible situation, with Edge winning the World Heavyweight Championship Sunday at TLC. My friend and I were talking about this, coupled with Christian showing up alongside Edge at the Slammies. If Christian is able to get healed up by the time the Royal Rumble rolls around, what would be the possibility of this scenario? Christian is the surprise entrant at the Rumble this year, wins it, and chooses Edge to face at WrestleMania for the title. Would you entertain the thought of that? I personally would love to see Edge versus Christian in a championship match at WrestleMania, but I doubt that Vince McMahon ever would. He doesn't look at Christian as being main event material. I could tell you that Christian is definitely not winning the Royal Rumble. He wouldn't be even if he were healthy, but I don't know that. I think the Rumble is too soon. I don't think he's going to be ready to come back until probably February. But here's why I think there may be a chance for this to play out at Mania. Christian doesn't have to win the Royal Rumble to face Edge at WrestleMania. The reason I say this, the SmackDown roster is so depleted right now. Who else really is there as far as being a fresh opponent for Edge to face if he is in fact still the champion come WrestleMania? I mean, they play hot potato with these titles so much that it wouldn't shock me for Edge to lose the belt in a month. But you've got Rey Mysterio, and I don't see them doing a babyface versus babyface title match. You've got Big Show. I don't want to see that match. You've got Undertaker, who may not even make it to WrestleMania. This Edge-Kane feud has to stop. I don't want to see Edge and Kane at WrestleMania. I'd rather shoot myself. So that leaves Alberto Del Rio. And I could see that. I could see them maybe shifting the belt over to Del Rio even before WrestleMania. But if Edge is still champion and Christian can come back, even if it is babyface against babyface, I think that would be fantastic. Edge and Christian for the championship at WrestleMania? Sign me up. Craig in the UK writes in, just came across your show tonight, and I have to admit that I'm hooked. Anyways, listening to episode 136 and you talking about Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler's disdain for Matt Stryker. Do you think that their feeling is due to them being afraid that Stryker is the best guy WWE has on commentary? Just my opinion, but Stryker is my favorite out of all the commentators in WWE or TNA. Thanks, and keep up the great show. Well, thank you, Craig. And I could tell you that their disdain for Matt Stryker has absolutely nothing to do with jealousy. More so Lawler, he really just doesn't like Stryker. He just finds him incredibly annoying, incredibly obnoxious, over the top, can't stand him, legitimately doesn't think he's any good. So I can tell you that's what Jerry Lawler thinks about that. Michael Cole, you know, I think Cole genuinely wants to help Stryker. Again, I don't think he's jealous of Stryker thinking he's the best. In fact, I think it's the opposite. I think he sees room for a lot of improvement with Stryker. At Survivor Series, apparently there were, tons of reports from people who were there that during one of the breaks in the show, after one of the matches, Cole took his headset off and was visibly yelling at Stryker. And apparently the reason was Stryker, he felt, was simply talking too much during the match. So, as good as you may think Stryker is, and Stryker is not horrible, I think a lot of it has to do with how he's produced by Vince McMahon or what he thinks Vince wants to hear. Because Stryker didn't used to be this bad. Stryker actually used to contribute a lot to the shows in that he would offer these nuggets of information, not unlike someone like Jim Ross might do, but it was legitimate stuff. It was legitimate background on a particular wrestler or a piece of wrestling history. And all of a sudden, Stryker started doing that, but he was feeding us bullshit. And it wasn't that he was wrong. He was giving us information that he thought was right, but it was actually wrong. He knows that what's coming out of his mouth is complete horseshit. It'd be like Matt Stryker calling a match and being like, oh, look at this, you know, Drew McIntyre just used a DDT. Did you know that, you know, Jake the Snake Roberts invented the DDT in the year 1961? I could easily picture him saying something like that, and it's complete bullshit, but he doesn't care. And, it may not drive you nuts, it drives me nuts, because people are watching this show, young people are watching this show, they're going to hear this, and they're going to think that everything he's saying is legitimate, and they're going to grow up thinking that all of this stuff is true, and none of it is true, and that bugs me about Matt Stryker. So I disagree with you as far as Matt Stryker being the best commentator in wrestling right now. I think Taz is very good in TNA. I think Josh Matthews is very good. Not perfect, but better than most in WWE. I would rank them ahead of Matt Stryker. Jonathan in the UK. A lot of UK letters this week. Dear Salamoser, I was recently looking back at some of the great WWF moments from the Attitude Era and noticed a distinct difference from today's product, the crowd. The audiences are much more tame these days, and we don't hear the roars that we used to, which send chills down my spine. Why, in your opinion, is this a rare, if not non-existent, occurrence in today's WWE product, and what can be done to revive the spirit shown in the past? It is not one factor that has anything to do with it, I think, but one of the overriding factors is the makeup of the crowd. If you go back and watch an episode of Raw from 1998, first of all, you'll see a sea, an absolute sea of signs. I think everybody at that show had a sign. You don't see that these days. And back in 98, unless the sign was really, really, really offensive, you rarely, if ever, I don't think you really ever heard of WWE confiscating a sign because the name of a WCW star was on it. Or because there was some rough language on it. I mean, if you had a sign that said, fuck you, and it was in the front row in full view of the camera, then yeah, maybe they would take it away from you. But you never heard of WWE censoring fans or confiscating signs, whereas now, if you go into a WWE show, and I've seen it myself with my own two eyes, as you're walking into the building, I remember walking into Madison Square Garden for the 2008 Royal Rumble. I wasn't even in the fucking building yet. And off to the side of where the ticket takers were a mound of signs that they had already taken away from people before they even entered the arena. You would never see that 10 or 12 years ago. So right off the bat, you're already kind of pissing people off and telling people, we don't give a shit what you think. We don't give a shit what you have to say. You're going to conform to what we think a crowd should look like. We don't want you saying this. We don't want you promoting that. Whatever the case may be. It's absolute censorship. It's their show. They can do what they want. But that's one small reason why crowds aren't necessarily as lively as they used to be. But that's actually not the point I'm trying to make. The overriding reason why, look at the makeup of the crowd in terms of age and in terms of demographic. there were a lot more fans back then going to the shows and paying money for a ticket who were in their late teens and early 20s. This was when wrestling was cool. And, you know, the 18 to 34 demographic was just on fire. And if you go to a show these days, you're more likely to see a lot of young people. A lot of young people. And by young, I don't mean age 18. I mean age 8. Who were there with their parents. And, you know, those crowds are just not going to react the same way that a crowd would have 12 years ago. They're not going to be as loud and as boisterous. And keep in mind, WWE would sell out a lot of buildings back then as well. They weren't necessarily booking very big buildings. You still had Raw that could be in a building that fits 8,000 people. But back in 98, they were more likely then than they are now to fill that building up with all 8,000 seats, except for whatever seats were being tarped off for the Titantron. Now, WWE, for a Raw show, is lucky if they can pack in 6,000 to 8,000 people. I mean, some weeks they'll have over 10,000, but that's rare. SmackDown? SmackDown's been in trouble for a while. I mean, for a SmackDown taping, and I'm not counting this past week, for a typical SmackDown taping of late, they're lucky if they get 3,000 to 4,000 people. So, right there, you're not going to have as boisterous a crowd with 3,000 people as you would back then if you had a building with 11,000 people. Wrestling is not hot. You know, to you and me, you know, we're fans of it, we watch it. You know, you're listening to a wrestling podcast right now. But to the general public, wrestling is nowhere near as hot as it was even a decade ago. That's the biggest reason of all why the crowds aren't as boisterous. You know, go back and watch when Steve Austin rode that Zamboni down to the ring in September of 98 and attacked Vince McMahon. The crowd was going apeshit. Apeshit. Why? Because that was exciting. I mean, Stone Cold Steve Austin, the top star in the company, the badass, Austin 316, riding into the building on a fucking Zamboni? Are you kidding me? Crashes the Zamboni into the ring, literally crashed it into the ring. Flipping people off, climbs on top of the fucking thing, jumps off, attacks Vince McMahon, beating the shit out of him. People are going crazy. Can you think of a moment in recent WWE history that comes even close to the intensity and the emotion and the fun factor of what we saw on that one night? And that's just one example. I mean, I marked out myself when that happened in 98. And there were a lot of things like that that happened. It didn't necessarily have to involve Steve Austin. You know, the stars back then were a lot bigger. You had Steve Austin, but you also had The Rock. You had Mankind. You had The Undertaker. You had DX. Vince McMahon himself was the biggest heel the company ever had. The stars now aren't nearly as over as they used to be. John Cena is still the company's golden goose. He's their biggest star. Randy Orton is a very big star, but Randy Orton is not Steve Austin. And that's why I keep saying it's unfair for people to keep calling him, you know, Stone Cold Randy Orton. I mean, I get that the company is kind of positioning him that way, and they want him to be the second coming of Austin. Orton has to focus on being the first Randy Orton, not the second Steve Austin, because there can never be another Steve Austin, just like there can be never be another Rock, no matter how charismatic a person may be. They have to kind of carve their own path. But the stars back then, because the product was so much hotter, there was so much more important, and they were so much larger than life than almost anybody now on the roster, except maybe for John Cena. So you don't have as many big-time stars. So there's a lot of different reasons why the crowds aren't as loud and as boisterous as they were. You ask me to name 5 moments off the top of my head from back in the day, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, with crowds that were just going crazy over a match or a return or an angle. I can name 5, no problem, off the top of my head. If you ask me to name 3 from the last 5 years, I'd probably sit here and struggle for a couple of minutes. I really would. And again, it just goes to show you the difference between then and now. All right, so that's going to do it for the mailbag. Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Folks, I have received an email from the anonymous Raw general manager here. And I have to read this, I guess. And I quote, "We'd like to announce that next week on episode 140 of the Sound Off, you, the Solo Monster, will be on the air talking about the best of WWE 2010. a top 10 countdown of the best matches, moments, angles, and so forth from World Wrestling Entertainment in the year 2010, an exclusive on Sound Off 140 right here next week on SCScoops.com. That comes from the anonymous Raw general manager, who I guess wanted to make sure I plug that one more time here before the end of the show. So I thank the anonymous GM for that. If you have feedback of your own, any letters you want to email in to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the email address to do so. That is my direct email address. And again, it's separate from sescoops@gmail.com, which is the main address for the site. You could send in questions there for the main page mailbag, which usually goes up every week around Thursday or Friday, courtesy of yours truly. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/solemonster, and friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolemonster, or you can do a Facebook search, and if you find the Solemonster Sounds Off official logo, send me a friend request that way. Again, I got one or two more emails from people who were claiming that they got the Sound Off through iTunes this past week, and it kind of cut off at the end. Let me know if you have the same problem this week. Again, by and large, people aren't really having that problem. So I don't know what the hell's going on. The full show is being uploaded. Everything seems to be okay on my end. Maybe try getting an RSS feeder. You can do that even on your mobile phone. You can download the Sound Off that way. There's a lot of different ways to get the podcast through iTunes, of course. But at the end of the day, you can just log on to scscoops.com, right-click Save As. That's probably the easiest and best way to get the show, aside from iTunes. So again, let me know if there's any problems. I don't think it's anything I'm doing, and hopefully we can get that fixed up for you real quick. So again, I want to wish a very Merry Christmas to those who celebrate. Hope that you got everything that you wanted to, spent time with family, friends, drank yourself to an early grave, whatever the case may be. We will be back here next weekend, New Year's weekend. It'll be the first Sound Off of 2011, which I guess makes this one the final Sound Off of 2010. So I guess having said that, I just want to thank each and every one of you for listening to the podcast. Some of you have been listening from the very beginning, or pretty damn close to it. Some of you have only been listening for a couple of weeks. It doesn't really matter. If you're listening to the show, I just want you to know that I appreciate it. Spread the good word of the Sound Off. Let your friends know. Maybe they'll enjoy the show. I'm always surprised to hear from people who either don't watch wrestling anymore, but get their wrestling fix specifically through this show, or just wrestling podcasts in general. I seem to be seeing more of that. And there are actually people who aren't even wrestling fans, or at least they claim that they're not wrestling fans and don't understand half of what I'm talking about, but they like the show anyway. I just find that amazing. So from whatever the case may be, thank you. This was a great year. Got a lot of podcasts done. I expect to do a hell of a lot more next year. I do not expect that to change. And here's to 2011 and beyond. So thank you all, and we will see you in 2011.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.